Welcome. Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to call to order the House Transportation Finance and Policy Committee. I'm John Kosnick, Chair, Republican Chair of the Committee. Welcome back to session. We will do just brief introductions to the couple of the new people as things have evolved. Got a new statement that is probably going to be read in most of the committees in regards to safety and decorum in the committees. So we'll start with that. Appreciate your interest and participation in the legislative process to ensure that we can view, hear, and understand today's and all the committee proceedings. We ask for your cooperation in maintaining decorum and civility throughout this hearing and committees throughout the year. For the safety, security, and comfort for all attendees, please note the following guidelines. The chair of the committee will maintain control of the proceedings and establish the following expectations. Signs and placards are not permitted in the hearing room. Verbal outburst, shouting, and disruptive behavior will not be tolerated. Applause and other audible demonstrations are not allowed. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in walkways, the aisles, or standing or obstructing at your chair is prohibited. If you require any accommodations, please speak with the sergeant at arms. Troopers and house security personnel are present for everyone's safety. Those providing testimony will be given a specific time limits, which we will helps us to stay on task and will be strictly observed. If you receive an entrance ticket, please retain it as it may be required for re-entry if you leave the room, use the restroom or something like that, or take a phone call. So keep your ticket, I guess. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in the removal of the hearing room. The purpose of our committees is for the members to have discussion and vet the bills and policy in front of us. Our goal is to conduct these proceedings efficiently while ensuring everyone the opportunity to observe and participate appropriately. And then the rules from last year are posted on the website. Representative Tapke and I may agree to vary from the rules from time to time if we choose. And then also, it's kind of stated in here for our lobbyist and guest, I would prefer that you do not come up to the table or to members as the meeting adjourns. Please let us have conversations to ourselves. And then also for safety, we don't want people approaching the table and limit that. And we're happy to talk with people in the hallways. I do want to start with a couple of introductions. We have our pages this year. I think they're new. We have Nick, if he can, he's over on this side, and then Ben is over here. Thank you for your help in the committee this year. So it's Nick Johnson and Ben Lewis. If you need some Lewin, I'm sorry. If you need some help with setting up the committee, I want to recognize the new DFL transportation chair, past member as well, Representative Brad Tapke. And please introduce your new member. But before we do that, our new staff, the new CLA is Kyle Baker, also my legislative assistant. So you'll be getting emails from him. And if you need to schedule meetings with us, contact Kyle or through my office. So Chair Tapke.
Thank you very much, Chair Kosnick. Excited to be here, excited to work with you this session and get a lot of things done for Minnesota. First, I want to say thank you to Representative Berg, who was last session on the Transportation Committee, and she is no longer on here, and that makes room for new member, Representative Luger Nikolai. And so I don't know if you want to have her introduce herself or how we'd like to do this, but excited to have her with us as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Meg Luger-Nikolai. I hail from 64A, which is a fine district in the middle of St. Paul, and I am excited to be here and doing the good work of this committee. Thank you.
Just a general reminder. General reminder, turn on the microphone. general reminder that we will direct conversation and discussion through the chair just to keep order on that, but we've been pretty good about that. With that, we have kind of a fun agenda today. No bills particularly in front of us, but I wanted to spend some time discussing a few important topics. We will begin with Margaret Donahoe with the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. Just a couple, quick 5 minutes. Tomorrow is Transportation Day at the Capitol, and so this is the first meeting before that. I wanted to give you an opportunity as transportation aficionados to hear about Transportation Day tomorrow and some of the things that the Alliance is working. Go ahead. Please introduce yourself, of course, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Margaret Donahoe. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. And hopefully you all have this handout. Just wanted to mention that, yes, tomorrow is Transportation Day at the Capitol. We will have our members from all over the state coming to St. Paul to meet with legislators, to talk about transportation priorities for this session. You're definitely invited to stop by. We'll be at the offices of the Council of Carpenters in St. Paul. It's just a mile or so away from here. You can feel free to come and go. And we really appreciate your support for transportation this session. So you'll also see we have our legislative priorities for this session. Our highest priority as we work to make Minnesota's transportation system safer and more effective is passage of a major capital bonding bill with funding for transportation programs and projects. As you can see from the handout, we support funding for all modes, and our asks represent the level of need that is out there and that has been articulated by MnDOT, the Metropolitan Council, as well as our partner organizations. The bottom line is that state bonds allow projects to get done. Authorizing state bonds for transportation leverages federal funds, local funds, reduces the burden on local property taxes, puts people to work right away in professional careers and well-paying jobs, and allows needed maintenance and improvement of public assets that Minnesotans rely on. The local bridge replacement program is one of our top priorities, has traditionally been funded in the bonding bill, because bridges really are a critical link in the transportation system that benefits the economy by providing connections for people and markets worldwide. State financial assistance to local units of government is necessary because of the significant number of bridges in our state, as you can imagine, and the associated relatively high cost for replacement of these important connections. The current five-year bridge list includes 924 bridges with an estimated total replacement cost of over $762 million. With an estimated need for $252 million in state bridge bonds. This includes bridges in counties, in large cities, in small cities, and in townships. The 2025 bonding bill appropriated $31 million in general obligation bonds for this program, with $11 million appropriated for major bridges. The funding provided in the bonding bill last year has all been allocated, and as of October 2025, requests for bridge funds are being added to a growing waiting list. The Local Road Improvement Program has been instrumental for allowing local governments to maintain and make safety improvements to important roadways. Without state assistance, local property taxes bear an increasing burden for this rising cost. The competitive 2025 local road improvement solicitation was released in September with a deadline of December 12th. And the Office of State Aid received 233 applications with requests for nearly $277 million in LRIP funding. Now, the bill last year provided $47 million for that program, leaving over $200 million in unmet funding requests for projects that are ready to go. The Local Government Roads Wetland Replacement Program is also an important need, as that program will exhaust wetland credits in the next few years that are used to provide the required wetland replacement for local government road projects. And this is a program that has chronically been underfunded. A recent analysis showed that $35 million is needed to overcome the credit deficit and annual funding of $9.5 million to maintain and support the program. The Board of Water and Soil Resources has indicated the program needs a combination of GO bonds and cash to try to catch up after years of underfunding. We're also supporting the request for $75 million in GO bonds for development of busway capital improvement projects. This would advance arterial bus rapid transit corridor development, including environmental analysis, engineering, design, right-of-way acquisition, and construction. Investments in BRT have proven successful in increasing ridership and contributing to economic development. BRT maximizes operating investments in transit by providing more attractive, faster service in heavily traveled bus corridors. And transit systems in Greater Minnesota also have important facility needs. These funds, if they are approved, would be for facility repair and improvements, specifically designed to meet vehicle storage, maintenance, operation, and administrative activities. Sustainable facilities add useful life to transit vehicles, provide safe storage, and improve overall vehicle and service performance. We're also supporting funding for ports and waterways. The four public ports have provided a list of future projects totaling $52 million. So $45 million, along with their local share, would go a long way toward making those projects happen. So we know that there are huge infrastructure needs across the state and limited bonding dollars. We really appreciate the level of funding for transportation in past bonding bills. And we want to stress that consistency is really important for transportation programs and projects. We know there's concern about how to find the dollars to pay debt service for a bonding bill this year, given the general fund forecast. But really, the impact on the general fund for the governor's bonding proposal is about $151 million over 3 years, so about $50 million a year out of general fund revenues of over $30 billion a year. So again, we really urge you to pass a bonding bill this year, put people to work, and allow for the economic growth that will improve the state's economy and allow for more general fund revenue in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that kind of brief overview. I think there's more on the flyer that members should be aware of that the Transportation Alliance is advocating for. So we will delve into that as session progresses. So thank you. Up next, we'll do the Minnesota Department of Transportation. We'll have a presentation for us. So if you want to make your way up there. In the meantime, Representative Brett Tabke, Chair Tabke, we didn't approve the minutes from the last meeting, Friday, April 11th, 2025. If you've had an opportunity to review those minutes, entertain a motion to approve them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would hand this, since Chair Cagle is on board at that point, I'm going to hand it off to her, if that's okay.
That'd be great.
I have taken a look at the minutes and had some flashbacks, but I would move adoption of the minutes from April 10th, 2025.
Okay. I hope your microphone was on. Chair Cagle moves to adopt the minutes from Friday, April 11th, 2025. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are approved. Thank you. Next, we have from the Connected Autonomous Vehicles Department, Division of MnDOT, Ms. Tara Olds, MnDOT Director of Connected Autonomous Vehicles. Welcome to the committee. We didn't have time last year to have you with us, so if you could give us about a 10-minute presentation, and then members will have about 10 minutes for questions if you do have some questions, but then we will move on to the next presentation after that. So please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your presentation, please.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tara Olds, and I am the Director of Connected and Automated Vehicles at the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I also have the pleasure of supporting and facilitating the Governor's Council on Connected Automated Vehicles. Before I get started, I just want to confirm, I think you all have the slides that I provided. Okay, I'm going to walk through those. On the first slide, I'll just start by providing a little background on connected automated vehicles in the Council in Minnesota. It was created by executive order in 2018 by Governor Mark Dayton and continued under Governor Waltz in his first and second term. The goal of the council is really to help the state prepare for connected and automated technologies and other transportation technologies. Under that, we've also established an innovation alliance, which is made up of committees that help the council move forward goals and priorities that are specific to each year. We also have the Department of Transportation that is preparing automated vehicles through testing, research, planning, policy, engagement, and partnerships, which is led by MnDOT's Connected and Automated Vehicles team. On the next slide, you'll see a little bit about automated vehicles. So what are automated vehicles? Automated vehicles use technology to steer, accelerate, and brake. They take over the traditional functions of a human driver and control a vehicle through computers that take in data in numerous ways. Quite frankly, take in data often more than a human can. Technology, sensors, computing, data inputs, decision-making processes all vary between companies, vehicle manufacturers, and technology developers. Most vehicles being sold in Minnesota today currently have lower levels of automated vehicle technology available. This technology may range from things like adaptive cruise control that helps you set your speed as well as following distance, or things like lane keeping assist that help you stay between the lines. Vehicles available for consumer purchase today in Minnesota, for like you and I, are not designed nor capable to be operated without a human in full control at all times. But for today's purposes, when I continue to talk about automated vehicles and policy of automated vehicles, I'm going to be focusing on higher levels of automation. Automated vehicles, specifically in levels 4 and 5, for those of you familiar with the SAE designations, which that's okay if you're not. But these are levels where a human driver is not required for vehicle operation. These types of vehicles are not available for public purchase, but are being developed and deployed and operated by organizations and companies. Next slide. Currently, Minnesota is one of around 16 states, I say because things are changing constantly, one of 16 states that does not have state regulations or rules on automated vehicles. This has created uncertainty for industry partners and potential loss of opportunity for our state to continue to explore. Most industry partners stress the importance of having clear legislation on the legality of driverless vehicles as a key component for them to look at investing in technology in specific states. At the federal level, there is no current federal legislation or regulation, leaving each state on their own to determine what is legal. There is anticipation that there will be some level of federal regulation in the near future, maybe later this year, but to what extent and what is included and what the timeline is on that is all still to be determined. Next slide. So why are we talking about automated vehicles? We really think in Minnesota that they have the potential to enhance the lives of Minnesota businesses, residents, and visitors. We think that they have the ability to increase safety, provide economic and workforce development, and increase accessibility. For safety, in 2024, there were over 460 traffic fatalities in Minnesota, with human behavior playing a role in many or most of them. While the number of fatalities in 2025 did decrease with less than 400, progress is being made. There's still ample work to be done to increase safety on our roadways and save lives. And we believe technology has the potential to help continue that downward trend if done appropriately. For economic and workforce, there's a number of technology startups and Fortune 500 companies in Minnesota that are working in this space already here in Minnesota, looking at automated vehicle technology and looking for opportunities to continue to attract more investment and continue to grow that investment already being made here. For accessibility, many Minnesotans face transportation challenges today, and automated vehicles have that potential to address challenges and enhance their quality of life, increase the transportation system opportunities, and help people get where they want to go. The extent to which these benefits will be realized is yet to be determined, and many states are enacting legislation and rulemaking to try to ensure that those outcomes are achieved. Next slide. The Governor's Council on Connected Automated Vehicles identified developing recommendations for automated vehicle policy as their top priority for 2025. With that, you can see the process that we undertook over the last year to prepare for future legislation discussions on this topic. So thank you for having me today to have this. We first took a look at automated vehicle laws across the country. This isn't new. Some states have had laws enacted for over 10 years. Some states are just looking at it right now. We wanted to learn from what's been done, what we could do different, what was specific to Minnesota. We also identified top and common themes that were included in legislation as well as discussion around this topic. We identified specific gaps in our own state legislation to understand what was currently needed and what would need to be addressed based on specific law needs. We engaged with over 70 different stakeholders to understand differing goals and perspectives. We developed council recommendations on how Minnesota should develop AV policy to address our state's needs and opportunities. This not only includes the council's recommended approach, but also acknowledges the documents, differing approaches and perspective, recognizing that our council has very unique perspectives and interests in mind. Lastly, one thing I wanted to note is that we'll be hosting Automated Vehicle Day at the State Capitol on April 14th from 1 to 4:30, be held in the Capitol Rotunda as well as the Capitol Mall. And we're inviting stakeholders from technology and vehicle providers, advocacy groups, educational partners to help educate and inform and expose people in our state, including you, stakeholders, and other public members about automated vehicles. Next slide. Lastly, I just want to end that we have developed several resources for policymakers to explore automated vehicles, which are shown on this slide. They can be found on our website, and I also will note that we do have some printed copies if anybody would like some of these. I encourage you to focus on two primary documents, which are the Automated Vehicle State Level Policy Themes Packet that includes all of the themes broken down, looking at different considerations we encourage the state to look at, not providing direction, but providing important questions that we think the state should look at and address. It also provides national consensus and direction of what other states are doing to know should we continue to follow or do we need to go our own way. And it has a stakeholder analysis with all of the information that we gathered over the last year. And the other document I encourage you to look at is the Council's recommendation on automated vehicle policy. Like I mentioned, this notes the recommended approach, but also the differing opinions and perspectives that might not have been the formal recommendation. At this time, I welcome questions and that the chair and committee may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Olds. I appreciate that overview, and I apologize if there was a presentation that we failed to put up on the TVs here. The next presentation, we'll make sure that we have that on there. But thank you for the handouts, and the website is dot.dot.state.mn.us/automated for those resources for people watching on TV or members. You have it on here also. Do we have any member questions? I'd just say that, you know, this is an exciting technology. For my perspective, I think it's something that the state of Minnesota needs to grab onto and embrace, certainly with a lot of the guidelines that we've seen in other states, but we should not discourage private industry from investing in Minnesota and leaving us behind. So I think that's a good thing to be talking about. We'll have some bills in this regard later in session. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has MnDOT or any of the organizations, you know, done any sort of visioning or looking at the future? Because I think this is going to happen fast, and it's going to become cheap, and this is the way people eventually will be able to travel. And so it. And not just personal vehicles, but I think the whole concept of transit is going to totally change. We're going to have individualized calls, you know, pods or calls on demand, you know, that. I mean, has MnDOT done any kind of visioning or thought about that from the future and what that would mean from our infrastructure system? Thank you.
Thank you. We do have a couple members, and I want to try to. We've got Representative Scraba, Jones, and Senator Murrah, and we'll try to take those and wrap it up, and we can continue this conversation afterwards. But to Representative Anderson's questions about transit usage, basically.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Yes, MnDOT has done some strategic planning a handful of years back, probably 5 or 6 years ago, where we looked at different scenarios to understand what our system may look like. I'll note that it is ever-changing, and it seems like every day it can kind of change on what the direction is going and how fast things are moving. When I first came into this space about 6 years ago, everyone in industry was pretty confident that in the next couple of years we would have fully automated vehicles driving in any condition, any weather, anywhere in Minnesota, 40 degrees below zero, blizzard condition. And I think that perspective and that that has changed, and it understanding that some things are a little bit harder. So as technology continues to improve, there continues to be a differing timeline of what we might see, both in the next year, 5 years, 20 years, 30 years. With that being said, a lot more investment has moved towards the technology that you might be able to consume on your own personal vehicle, which is those lower levels of automation as well. But with that being said, transit's a great opportunity of looking at how you can continue to use this technology to enhance our transportation system. And one of the things that we continue to look at as the state is what can our role be to help continue to proactively look at areas that maybe capital investments aren't going towards so that we can help make sure that those are challenges that our state will continue to invest in. So when we look at the technology that might be rolled out in more urban centers, we know that there's a lot of challenges in rural communities as well. That might be an area that the state can continue to help move forward in.
Okay.
And then from an infrastructure perspective, I'll just note with automated vehicles, most companies say there's no infrastructure investments that they need
they may benefit from, but they don't need them.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Olds. I just have a couple of questions around what you're seeing from, like, what are we learning from other states? Particularly, so one question, as I understand, so California is probably the most ahead on this, and they have a pretty robust data collection, especially around, like, VMT and things like that. So I'm wondering, are the recommendations or the things you're coming out with, does it, are you trying to take best practices from there? And then the second one is, so I represent downtown Minneapolis, and so it's a very dense area. And as I've been doing some research on AVs, I understand that at least some of the data that we're seeing in California is that up to 30% or more of miles driven by AVs are not carrying people, or they're not even on their way to carrying people. So I'm worried about the traffic or the potential congestion, particularly in our area. I understand AVs can have many different applications, but I just specifically am thinking about that and wondering if you could comment on that.
We've got just very limited time, so a brief answer, please, and maybe you could follow up offline. I think it's a great question. I don't want to this is just an introduction, so we're not intended to have a hugely robust discussion, but I wanted members to have an idea of some of that stuff. So if you could answer that, and then we'll try to get to Representative Spencer Murrah, Scraba, and maybe Myers.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Yes, we are learning from other states. I'll note that in our documents, we do have some examples of different approaches that states have taken, from very restrictive and requiring extensive data reporting and the benefits and the challenges and setbacks with that, recognizing there's pros and cons to both approaches, as well as states that have taken a less restrictive approach and some of the pros and cons with that. Happy to go into more details, just trying to be mindful of our time.
Thank you.
Offline. And then with regards to the vehicles traveled, definitely a question that local jurisdictions are very concerned about, and understanding how vehicles operate. So discussions that we definitely can have.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Spencer Murrah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for allowing me to go before Representative Scraba, because Waymo's in Minneapolis, but I hear they're going to Grand Marais next. So my question is about my question's about the certification piece. So can you explain a little bit about what certification is, and then how is that handled in other states? I think, you know, I have heard a concern that it's a little bit like industry regulating industry, and how are different states approaching that? And as part of the recommendations from the work group, are there recommendations around that? Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. with regards to certification, that's probably one of the hardest areas I think that everybody in industry recognizes. When we look at traditional roles that the federal government plays, that's normally where they step in. And one of the areas I would say that most states are advocating for the federal government to try to create that interoperability uniformed approach.
Thank you. Let's move on to Representative Scraba, and I'm very serious. Please keep the question very short if you want a very short answer, and then we're going to move on.
I was in Austin this fall, and they are automated. They're all over. It's something to behold, really nice. I've listened to TED Talks about companies starting businesses. For the life of me, the TED Talks are very informative, like question that Representative Spencer Murrah had, very informative. But do we have to recreate the wheel? Can we not look at industry and say, they don't want empty vehicles? And keep going back and forth. They have a plan and software and everything to work. Have we looked at that? Have we looked at that approach? Or is
Ms.
it all just government dumb? Thank you.
Ms. Olds, please.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. I would note that as we really explored this, we were looking at it from a vehicle classification perspective, less from a business regulation, noting that traditionally cities are looking at ordinances managing the business regulations.
Thank you very much. And we are going to get to Representative Vice Chair Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Director. I'm not going to ask a question, but I am going to ask if you would follow up with us on any previous or current AV programs that you think are notable that have taken place here in Minnesota. If there's things that you think are of importance, I would love to hear that from you and maybe share it with the committee.
You can do it verbally if you can do it in about a minute or two, and then we'll proceed with the next presentation.
I can. I'll note that there are two ongoing pilots here in Minnesota. Both Southwest Transit has a Southwest Prime automated vehicle pilot that they've been working on with May Mobility. So that's down in Eden Prairie, if anybody's interested in checking that out. They're not fully automated yet, but that's what they're working towards. And then May Mobility is also working in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, with a number of different partners under a project that started under state DOT, now is under Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation with federal funds.
Thank you. And those are two great questions, because the public should know that there are some test programs already occurring in the state. So we will probably have you back, I'm sure, as we progress through session. So thank you for your presentation. If I can make sure that the pages help, make sure that the next presentation is available through the laptop system, and then we'll have the Met Council give their report on high subsidy transit route analysis. And presenting will be Charles Carlson, Director of Minnesota Transportation Services. And it's getting set up. And members, this was the report that we are going to be briefed on here today was part of last transportation package that we have. From my perspective, again, we're trying to create, make sure that our taxpayer dollars are used as efficiently as possible, and all modes of transportation, and recognizing that there could be better ways to operate our bus systems and better operations and administration. So we have this report that you guys should have in your packets online. And Mr. Carlson, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation, and then we'll want to leave ample time. I'll cut you off if I need to, so that we can have member discussion and questions. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members. My name is Charles Carlson. I serve as Executive Director for Transportation Services at the Metropolitan Council. This report is on a high subsidy transit route analysis that was completed. Before I dive into the report, I just want to remind the committee that transit, although we talk about high subsidy routes for a portion of the service area that we operate, transit is an essential mode in the region. So this is not a report about transit being unimportant. Quite the contrary. It's about making sure that we have cost-effective and efficient and productive transit services across our region, because transit is essential. It provides vital access. It advances our economy. It's one of the safest modes of travel available. Taking the bus is 50 times safer than driving. Environmental benefits that are significant, and it's also popular. So we have a growing system, and folks are using transit every day. About a quarter of the region's population uses transit at least once in a typical year. About 160,000 people use transit twice a week or more. Some people use it just occasionally, but it's very important for many people in the region. About 57,000 households in the region do not own a vehicle, so it is all the more important for them. It is also an essential strategy for getting around in an affordable way, especially as vehicle prices and insurance and associated costs with automobiles have grown, and we recognize that about 55% of transit riders have household incomes less than $60,000, so significant role in the region for our transit system. This study, then, is, as the chair mentioned, a product of the transportation bill in 2025. It charges the council to report on calculation of per passenger operating subsidies by route type, to estimate the cost of discontinuing the highest subsidy tier routes that are defined in our plan, and to estimate the cost of metro mobility associated with those routes. So just to define that briefly, transit is delivered using public funds as well as passenger fares. Providers have various costs and according to their operating models that they allocate across their service and across their routes. Operating costs of a route less the fare revenue for a route is the subsidy, and then divided by passengers on that route is the subsidy per passenger. And so that's what we are reporting on through this project. Guidance is established for per passenger subsidies in the region's transportation plan, Imagine 2050 and the transportation policy plan. Transit providers report these costs and ridership and service levels to the council every year in a route analysis. So this is using the products of that annual reporting in the report that is submitted, is from the providers themselves. So routes in that analysis are compared by route type. So in the table here, there's a listing of the different types of routes and then across service days. So Route 7 operating on weekday, Saturday, and Sunday would count as three routes, even though it's using one number, because we compare across service days as well as by route type. So we're not comparing a core local bus with a suburban local bus. They're very different services. For that reason, we differentiate by route type in our reporting. The purpose of this is really to assist transit providers in making decisions for their own service areas. By using this data and through this reporting process, transit providers can improve the cost effectiveness of their services and allocate resources effectively in their service area. Within our plan, we have three intervention levels that are based on the per passenger subsidy as you go up to 20 to 35% over, 35 to 60% over, or more than 60% above a peer route average. Our plans would call for minor modifications, major changes, or to actually restructure or likely eliminate a route. And so the thresholds are shown in the table here, where you can see that a core local bus or a local bus might be around $13, $37 for a suburban local bus. Some of the least expensive services per passenger are actually the high capacity modes of BRT or light rail. But in this report, we really deal in the category shown in the red box. So the tier three, restructure or eliminate. To borrow an automotive term, tier one is sort of a tune-up. Tier two is an overhaul. Tier three is you start to think about the scrapyard.
If I could just pause for one second, a question on this. So we're comparing the subsidies, but it's per passenger, but it's not per passenger mile.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. So a per-passenger subsidy is what's defined.
Okay, so if we did per-passenger mile, we might get a different result on yep. top of that? Okay, we can revisit that later. Thank you.
The report identifies the savings associated with eliminating these routes, and I will show that, but I wanted to begin by saying that transit providers use a number of different tools to manage service and subsidy, including ridership changes, changing the provider, reducing cost drivers, reducing service, exploring other service options, or eliminating routes. And I'll briefly describe what transit providers do for each of these. Sometimes you don't need to do anything to reduce the subsidy. Occasionally, ridership may increase. That spreads cost over a larger number of passengers. And this is especially in the case of new services. In the report, we talk about Route 46 in Minneapolis and Edina was reintroduced after being suspended for many years on weekends. It was a high subsidy report, or it's a high subsidy route in this report because it only operated for about 2 weeks in 2024. Over 2025, ridership roughly tripled on that route, so it should be in much better shape going forward. So sometimes ridership increase is enough. Changing providers is the next tool. This is one that we use at the Met Council significantly. Contracted services cost sometimes less than directly operated service. We use this particularly on suburban local routes. We have a regional goal to contract roughly 20% of regular route services. So in the report, Route 25 was a high subsidy route in 2024. In December of 2025, we actually switched it from Metro Transit to a contracted route that we operate out of Metropolitan Transportation Services. So because we're able to leverage a lower cost delivery, especially for higher subsidy routes, we're able to contain subsidies by reducing cost. Similarly, reducing cost drivers can be a way to decrease cost. So removing overhead costs, efficient scheduling, or other efficiencies that a provider may find can help lower the cost of any individual route. Importantly, some of these costs may be outside of a provider's control. If we could get gas for free, that'd be great. We can't, so that's a cost driver that we don't control.
services that different providers operate and their models vary pretty extensively. So overhead costs and corresponding costs may vary. Reducing service is often the most common approach. So this would be running buses less often, maybe running later, ending the service day earlier in the evening rather than running later into the night, where ridership may be lower, can save cost and therefore reduce subsidy. However, in this case, lower ridership could also result, and then subsidy may not go down as much as planned. Changing the service type is another option. So regular route service may not match every market that it operates, and moving toward a demand responsive service like microtransit or Transit Link that we operate across the seven county region could better match the market and access, and maybe a tool that a provider would consider. And then finally, as is the focus of this report, eliminating savings. This would result in the greatest amount of money saved, but would result in some cases in a complete loss of regular transit access.
And Mr. Carlson, we'll kind of pause here. We'll see how this goes to take questions maybe while we go through it.
Sure.
It's different than waiting till the end, but I want to make sure we get through the report too. So Representative Kraft had a question, and I presume relevant to the area that we're talking right now.
Yes.
Great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, two things came up. The change providers question, I wanted to, point you made, you're saying that if you have a route that's not doing well, sometimes you can contract with a third party and that can reduce costs. Why would that be? That doesn't intuitively make
sense. We'll give you a follow-up and then we want to just take that part. Is that okay, yeah. Representative Kraft?
Yeah,
sure.
Be great.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it is a strategy that we use at Met Council. So some routes are directly operated by Metro Transit. Other routes are operated through a contract provider. We have two transportation divisions, Metro Transit and MTS, or Metropolitan Transportation Services. Our contract rates we competitively procure for and are often low.
Follow-up, Representative Kraft?
I'd have to process that.
So it was Metro Transit, and what was the other division?
Metropolitan Transportation Services, or MTS.
You contract out.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you contract out from MTS with someone else. It's not in contracting in. And they can provide service on a route more cost effectively than you can on your own. Why?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft. A variety of factors. Often they're working with lower overhead. They may be paying drivers a different rate or mechanics a different rate. It really varies contract by contract. It's also a competitive environment that we contract and procure in. I'll also note that other providers in the region also contract their services out. It varies a bit. Some maintain their buses and contract the drivers. But having that market, leveraging the marketplace is a way that providers can manage cost.
Okay. Did you have a second question too, Representative Kraft? Please proceed.
Yeah. I'll just note that I have a queasiness with the idea that we can provide it for a certain thing, and then we can find another provider who can pay employees less to provide the service. And I wonder, wonder how much less. So anyway. But just a comment. My question, you talk about reducing costs by potentially reducing service. And this may have been represented elsewhere, but can't you sometimes reduce costs by increasing service because you increase ridership more by if people have more frequent service? I've seen that happen in other cities. So how does that factor into your thought?
Yeah, Mr. Carlson. Chair, Representative. It really depends on the particular circumstances. A route may be more cost effective by operating more frequently, especially if there becomes then a critical mass of ridership to support it and spread those costs over more people. But it really varies case by case and by market.
Good. Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have similar concerns as to what Mr. Representative Kraft stated. So not only on the labor side, but is there a difference in quality when you're contracting out?
Mr. Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, we establish pretty firm expectations on service quality, and really the intent when we're contracting service is that customers don't notice a difference in the quality of service between our operations, whether it's directly operated or contracted. Additionally, we also specify minimum required wages in our contracts, particularly for drivers. And this is the case for regular route, but also for our demand response service and for Metro Mobility.
Thank you. Sorry, I have two more questions and I'll combine them. One is, so who, can you give an example of who you're contracting out to? And then two, why have a specific 20% contracting goal?
Mr. Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, two of our regular route contractors are Schmitty & Sons as well as Transdev. So they're two of the larger contractors in the region. We have additional contractors on Metro Mobility Services. I'm sorry, could you, Representative, remind me the second part?
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why the goal of 20% to contract that out?
Sure. Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, really it's to have a balance of matching service with the cost, with the markets and the costs that may be incurred. So having cost-effective service across a wide range of geography lends itself to a target around that area. Also just to have a balance of providers across the region, so enough to support several contracts and contractors in the region, as well as recognizing the role of direct operation.
And then Representative Cagle has a question, and then we'll kind of proceed, and then we'll have hopefully time for more general questions too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe not so much of a question, but this feels like a way to get around union membership and benefit sets and not really taking into account the well-being of the employees that are providing these services. And so this is actually very concerning to me, because we've seen what's happened with, you know, when we have private entities, you know, doing government services, and it takes the public good and the public drive out of it and puts it more on profit motives. And so this just, it feels wrong to kind of go around some of the benefits and the labor contracts in order to achieve cost savings on the labor side. I really think that we should be looking at other ways to achieve cost savings besides on the backs of the workers.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have a mix of union and non-union environments in our contracted services, so there is a mix there as well.
And then I might suggest, but I think maybe when we dive into it deeper, the contracted services provides a flexibility to operate the routes as well, if I'm not mistaken. And I know this, you know, talking to different contract providers, you wouldn't be able to meet the demands in some areas, would you?
Mr. Chair, there is more flexibility in terms of revising routes. So especially sometimes new routes, we may be more likely to contract given that increased flexibility to tailor service.
Okay, a good discussion to have, and we'll continue to have that. If we could continue with the presentation then.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. So this, now we'll move into results of the high subsidy analysis. This slide shows the routes operated in the region and then those three thresholds. This is for 2024 across service days. So out of 264 routes that are operated by all providers, 206 met guidelines, 16 were that level one or the tune-up recommendation, 14 in level two, and then 28 in level three. And you can see the breakout across providers there. So in the case of the council, 87% of routes, and we'll talk about this more in expenditure in an upcoming slide, met our guidelines, and a very small share were in that high subsidy category. Translating this into cost, so this is where we estimate the savings, and I'll call your attention in the report. We break this out on a per route basis, so you can look at the subsidy of any individual route that is in this category. The annual cost, the subsidy per passenger, and then how that compares to the regional average. So in 2023, we reported for 2023 and 2024, because they're the 2 years most recently available, we'll request this data from providers as 2025 reporting gets closed out sometime this spring, and then we would have a performance report prepared over the summer. But for 2023, out of $508 million of regular route operating costs, $21.8 million was operated on high subsidy routes, and that varies provider to provider, as shown in the table. For Met Council, our service represented over 97% not in this category. So that's the 2023 result. And then in 2024, a very similar story regionally, where around 4% of service was in the high subsidy category. And it varies across providers as to the percentage. This slide also shows a estimated capital savings. What that reflects is the cost of buses used on that service, not an annual cost, but a one-time cost of buses that are associated with high subsidy routes across providers. So using 2026 pricing for an average 40-foot bus, or in the case of a suburban local bus, a 30-foot bus to estimate one-time capital savings. This map shows where those high subsidy routes are located. Purple, blue, and green shapes behind the lines on the map are what are called transit market areas. This is a tool we use at Met Council that estimates likely demand for transit services. It's developed using a number of different built form and demographic factors. In the bottom left corner, you can see the actual formula that calculates this. There won't be a test. This indicates what types of transit services may be effective in different areas. We also provide guidance in our plan around service design criteria. So how often should a route run in a given area? What span of service should a route operate? High subsidy routes may indicate a mismatch between that guidance and service on the street. So this is a tool we offer regionally. And then the lines on this map are the 2024 routes. They're color-coded by provider, not by subsidy, so you can see the different routes. And then in blue on this map are the all the other routes that are operated across the region. The next section gets into metro mobility. So the last piece of the legislation was to estimate the cost of metro mobility rides near high-subsidy routes. And I'll describe how we did that and where we came up with it, Mr. Chair.
If we could pause for a second, Representative Joy has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you go back to on slide 9? You talk about the route operating, the capital savings, and Minnesota Valley Transit shows 26%, and the Plymouth Metro shows 35.1%. Can you elaborate a little bit on that or clarify that for us?
Mr. Chair, Representative. So each of these providers, this is their regular route operating costs, so they may have other services as well, but of the regular route, in the case of Minnesota Valley, $28.8 million, 7.6 of that was on the routes listed in the report that operated in that third tier high subsidy. That comprised 26% of their operating.
So that percentage is a percentage of the routes that are very high subsidy? Is that
7.6 million, very high subsidy, Mr. Chair, out of 28.8 million across, so 26% of the regular route total.
And then 35 for Metro Lincoln?
35 for Plymouth, 0% for Southwest or Maple Grove in 2024, 2.7% of Met Council. And then the regional total, because most service is operated by Met Council, 4.1%.
So since you're the Met Council, are you comfortable with the 2.7% that you're operating?
Mr. Chair,
because the numbers are a little staggering, very, very different. Big difference between 2.7 and 26% or 35. What's a baseline that what is acceptable? Zero?
Mr. Chair, our transportation plan develops and issues this as guidance for providers to manage cost-effective service. So within the Met Council, we work on a quarterly basis to adjust our service to meet demand, to be cost effective, to provide access across communities. Other providers do that the same way according to their communities and in alignment with the resources they have to provide service. We have regional guidance, and because we have regional guidance, we have recommendations for what providers should consider. We make those decisions on the council's behalf. The other providers are really subject to their individual boards under the authority that the state gives them to run their service. So it's really a question for how they manage their service. But the council's guidelines are that we should not have high subsidy routes, and they should be addressed through minor, moderate, or major changes.
Do you have a follow-up or comment? Okay, thanks for I think that's probably the crux of this whole report here is if you've got 26% or 35% or, you know, for the region it's 4% of rides that are extremely expensive to provide, I think our challenge is how do we remedy that to respect the taxpayers and still continue to provide good transit service that people actually need and not highly subsidized routes that people aren't using. So is that a good analysis of what these numbers might help us as policymakers?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So the last section of the report, the last couple slides here, deal with the cost of metro mobility, the special transportation service, and the interaction between high subsidy routes and the metro mobility program. So as a state forecasted program, metro mobility costs are paid from the state general fund on a forecast basis, and that took effect July 1st of this year, of last year. Services are provided on metro mobility in two areas, and they're shown on this map. There's a federally mandated area. These are for trips along all day local routes. So the blue blob areas on this map show a three-quarter mile buffer around all day local routes was effective in 2026. That is the federally mandated area. How you reserve and how we deliver that service differs slightly from the state mandated area, which is shown in the black outline and is defined in state law. So we have similar on-time performance between these areas. We fulfill trips in both of these areas. The difference is that in the federally mandated area, we schedule a trip immediately. It must be within 1 hour of the time that it is requested. The state mandated area, we have a little more flexibility to work with a customer to schedule the trip. Perhaps providing the trip in an off-peak period could present a savings to the state. But we define and manage these services in both of these ways. High subsidy routes require federally mandated paratransit service, often at high cost. So that is what we were looking at and what we'll describe in more detail on the next slide. The areas shown in orange on this map are the portions of those federally mandated ADA service areas that are near all-day high subsidy routes. Minus the areas that are covered by non-high subsidy routes. So that's why there's sort of a clipped appearance in some cases to the shapes, the orange shapes on this map. From trips that began or ended in those areas in orange, we calculated for each trip the miles of paratransit service. We multiplied it by the cost of metro mobility on a per mile basis, and that gave us the cost of metro mobility trips that are affiliated with these high subsidy routes. That is shown in this table. So in 2023, the total was around $368,000, accounting for three routes that created that level of service. In 2024, that total was $6.1 million, accounting for additional routes. Particularly in the Shakopee area and for a total of six routes, as well as a difference between which Metro Transit routes were high subsidy in each year. So it's not that the trips grew that much between 23 and 24, but the mix of routes that required the federally mandated service level increased, and then two, the cost associated with trips to that area increased between the 2 years. So from a little less than a half million to a little over 6 million between the 2 years as the state's cost for Metro Mobility associated with high subsidy routes. So in conclusion, Mr. Chair, this report requires three things: per passenger operating subsidies, savings from discontinuing those routes, and estimating the cost of Metro Mobility. We recognize that transit is a valuable public service, and for that reason, transit providers do evaluate and report costs that we've tabulated in this study. High subsidy routes are those that have subsidies more than 60% above a peer route average, and that varies from $24 to $201 per route, and that's as shown in the tables in the report. That represents a varied but low overall regional share of 4.1%, but 0 to 26% or more. Discontinuing those routes would save $23 million annually and up to $72 million in capital expenses, and then the Metro Mobility costs are about 6% of the Metro Mobility program, or around $6 million in 2024. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Anderson, and then I believe Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are these routes, who determines where these routes are in the suburbs? Because they're clearly that's where we have the issues, you know, with the high cost routes. Is that dictated by the council or us or
Mr. Carlson?
Thanks.
Yeah. Who designs the routes? Is that kind of?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have different transit providers in the region. So Met Council is one of the providers. There's also Southwest Transit and Minnesota Valley Transit Association or Authority, Plymouth and Maple Grove. They each operate independently as transit systems with powers from the state to operate transit, and then the Met Council for the region more broadly. So route design, the service level provided, is a function of each board's priorities and their process. What we do at Met Council is we have guidelines for what providers should consider. And then we manage our service as an entity ourselves.
Representative Anderson, yeah.
Thank you. So the boards themselves are making the decisions on the routes. That's what you're saying. And the boards themselves could decide, you know, hey, we shouldn't be running routes that have this kind of, you know, cost, because that's crazy, some of these costs. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative, correct. So boards have authority from the legislature and manage their service in accordance with their priorities and resources.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. How does the Met Council, do you have a board, or is it the Met Council members that tell you, hey, you need to redo these lines for the Met Council specifically?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the Met Council, the governing body of the Met Council serves as our board. So we, through our budget process, through our regular service updates, through reports such as this one, can bring information and make decisions around service that we operate across the region.
But do you have a smaller board outside of the Met Council members that help direct, you know, employees that say, hey, you know, this route is going? You said you had 2.7% of your routes could do better or high subsidy. Did you internally make those decisions within your management team then?
Mr. Chair, a lot of the changes and a lot of the day-to-day route management that Metro Transit does are really at the staff level and reported through our transportation committee and then our board under the budget that the board adopts.
Great, thank you. Representative Kraft, I believe, and then Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand this MVTA number on cost of Metro Mobility near high subsidy routes, because it's going in 1 year from $80,000 to $5.2 million. Like, what You may have said that I just didn't get through my thick skull. Like, what happened there? Like what was the huge change?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Is there a page you're referring to, Representative Kraft, so I can follow?
Right there.
Is part of the presentation?
Slide okay. 14.
Right there.
Which slide? 14. Okay. Mr. Carlson, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft. The difference here is that there are three routes that increased service in 2024 that brought it from the state mandated threshold into the federally mandated threshold, and therefore were part of the analysis that we completed. So routes that didn't, the Shakopee Prior Lake area in orange here, that would not have been on the map previously.
Routes were added.
They were okay. Existing routes frequency increased to the level that prompted the federally mandated service for Metro Mobility.
Okay. Thank you.
So the trips were provided in that area, but they weren't associated with a high subsidy route because that route previously hadn't met the threshold for federally mandated paratransit service.
Go ahead. I've got time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the service was being provided before, but just wasn't being counted here. Is that what you just said? And then if so, did the service change so much? Or?
Mr. Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative. The service level increased, and that brought it into this category. I think in both years, they were high subsidy routes, just not operating frequently enough to trigger federal ADA paratransit.
Okay, all right, thank you.
So by having a high subsidy route, not very frequent, but when the provider increased the frequency of that route that was still very high cost to operate, then it triggered a higher level of Metro Mobility, is that
correct?
Summarize
correct,
what,
Mr. Chair.
An additional cost to us, is that right?
That is correct, and Mr. Chair, we endeavor to provide a very similar or identical service level between state and federally mandated areas. Fact of the matter is, though, that we have more flexibility with the state mandated area. Trips can be scheduled or arranged to really deliver in a very cost-effective way, whereas federally mandated, we really size our system all day around the peak of the peak demand in order to ensure that we're meeting the federally mandated service.
Thank you. Representative Joy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, when I look at that growth for the question, you know, you see from 80,000 to 5.2 million and that type of growth and how much you could be close to $200 per passenger, depends on where it's at. You know, it's almost not discrediting what you guys do, but it's almost like we should go to an Uber system because it's just like it's continually increasing so much when we're trying to be good stewards of taxpayers' money. I think we really need to think about, I mean, just growth like that in 1 year, what that's going to look like in year two if they add a route, or just, I mean, really coming down to digging in how this number grows so much. Thank you. That's just my opinion and your guys' thoughts. I'll take feedback. Thank you.
Yeah, if you want to comment, is it easier to do independent contracted rides, or basically?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and member, we do actually offer a taxi subsidy alternative to Metro Mobility where a customer would pay the first $5. We would provide a subsidy up to the next $20, and then the customer would be responsible for any amount thereafter. That is a taxi program. We're actually not delivering paratransit service at that point. The customer is opting for that. It's compared to a $45 or so subsidy average on a Metro Mobility trip, that taxi program can offer a savings to the council. The challenge is, would that trip otherwise have been taken on Metro Mobility, or is it just an additional service, which may be convenient, but is not a one-for-one cost savings?
Thank you. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so with those, that map with the little section down there, that is not a route that Metro Transit sets. That's a route that MBTA would set. And then because they set that route, it causes Metro Transit to have to pay more into Metro Mobility.
Mr. Chair, member, that's correct.
Okay.
That Metro Mobility responds to the service that all the transit providers put out on the street. We follow the regular route system with our federally mandated area, and the costs from the state or the funding from the state flows with that.
Thank you. So Metro Transit didn't have control over how that high subsidy route was placed, but then they did have to respond to the federally mandated services and are required to provide those. So it was kind of something out of their control, but then had to respond to. I have another question about when you were looking at the subsidies, do you include the holistic picture of like what it costs to build a BRT line and add that into kind of the lifetime analysis of how much that adds to the, I guess, subsidy, and comparing that across different transit modes?
Mr. Chair, awesome. Member Cagle, the evaluation in this report is solely on the operating costs of this. So capital build out would be a separate, is not included in this total.
Okay. And I just wanted to kind of highlight the fact that looking at some of these tables, the table 3, A3 in the report, and A4 in the report shows that there's subsidy per passenger $206.93, there's a 109 one in here somewhere, I think. So just a reminder, the per passenger subsidy on North Star was $116 to $119. So if we're outraged about that, we should be really outraged about this. So I hope to hear some like really fiery speeches on the floor. And so I want to make that point too. And I think it would be valuable too to see about how the cost versus subsidy and how that stacks up against each other to really see a true picture of what is the best bang for our buck when it comes to Metro Transit or, you know, transportation in different modes. So I think that was just more statement than a question, but I think there's a lot of information that we can kind of dig down even deeper on to figure out really how to maximize the system, what modes are going to be the best and the lowest subsidy. And then another question I had too was if we've seen any reduce in the per passenger subsidy since the trip agents have been enacted, especially around the light rail lines with fare enforcement, if we've been able to see any kind of, better fare recovery.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Member Cagle, I don't have a specific evaluation of that. I would note that this is for 2023 and 2024. The biggest ramp up of increased official presence, you know, certainly began across that period, but 2025 may be a great representation of that effect, and we don't have that as part of the report.
It would be very interesting to get that data, so see how effective that program is.
We can look into as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. I am a little bit outraged. You know, when you see subsidies of $201, and you pointed it out, $105, $102, even $90, and some of the other ones that are even less than that, you're right, they're less than North Star, and I think that's why it was important to have this report, and we'll be working on some draft legislation, and there's been discussions on how this is what the charges of this committee, and how can we more effectively deliver transit systems and rides that people need to use in a more effective and respectful taxpayer form. And when you see, you know, $200 a ride subsidy, that definitely cannot continue, and it's an abuse of taxpayers. So there is outrage. We're just kind of first day of session, maybe getting our wheels under us or something, but I hope there is a shared outrage, and if you have some, I'm glad to share that with you. So members, you know, on page 5 of that report, we have it right in there. And we'll continue. If you have some additional ideas about this, let us know, because we're going to definitely revisit this on that. So thank you, Representative Cagle, and I think your BRT question, I think that we can, when we start saving more money on ineffective routes, we can provide routes that people will use. So if that's where you're headed, I think we should continue to talk. Representative Anderson had another question.
Thank you. I just have a follow-up question, and I apologize that I don't understand exactly the funding on this. So if I'm one of the, say, MBTA, for example, and I decide I'm going to have a create a route X, but it happens to have a high subsidy, which only I know about. So how do they get the money to cover this? Do they just send a bill to the Met Council? Or how's this actually getting paid? And then is there follow-up? I mean, obviously, whoever's running these organizations is aware that there's high subsidy routes, but is that reported anywhere outside of this little entity? Thank you.
Mr. Carlson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, thank you for the question. So transit funding in the region is distributed in part by state law. So there's a share of motor vehicle sales tax that by law goes to the different replacement service municipalities, the MVTAs and other providers in the region. Other funds are set by council policy to allocate funds. So sales tax funds are allocated by council policy. Federal funds are allocated using a federal formula that we adopt by policy in the region. And then from those funds, transit providers decide how to allocate their resources to serve their communities. So it's an independent allocation, but the council and the state are the funders of these other entities.
Please follow up. If
very
you
quick.
Clarify.
So it isn't per mile. They simply get whatever dollars are allocated to their organization, and they decide how to spend them. And so they're making the decision to spend money on routes that are obviously known rides, you know, that are high. So they're just making those decisions themselves, and they could choose to make a decision to either not have it or to spend it somewhere else. And one more follow-up. So if they didn't have that route, these high subsidy routes, what would happen to those dollars if they were eliminated?
Mr. Carlson?
If the routes were eliminated, those funds could be available for other services in the region elsewhere, in their service area, or, you know, if it was more funding than was needed, you know, across other providers. But the funds are distributed on an allocation basis, not on a per route basis or a per ride basis. It's a share of the total funds.
Okay, thank you.
And then the correlation with that is when that service requires Metro Mobility service associated with it, that is a cost of the state in the general fund, and we develop that as what's required to operate as a mandated service in the area.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question on how it's funded. Maybe we should have, I thought maybe, you know, with the time that we have, maybe we should have put together more of a background on that we've talked about it in the past, but not very recent. But there is always, there's a tension there with the suburban opt-out providers and the Met Council as the taker of a lot of federal funds that come in addition to the state funds, and how much allocation other providers should get. But when you see $200 a ride, you got a question. Do you even need more money, and are you using the funds allocated effectively to the taxpayers and providing that you're not providing routes that anybody's riding or in significant numbers anyways? Representative Olson, and then we have our newest member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Carlson, we have decades and decades and decades of data on riders, on population distributions within the metro area. Can you, you know, we're looking at these costs as subsidies, $201.11, $102.20 per person getting on that vehicle, taxpayer money. It begs the question of why did we create this one in the beginning? You know, you could have looked at the data and you'd maybe know that this isn't going to work, or maybe can you walk through for us the creation of a route? Because if we're looking at these high subsidy routes and we're saying today Maybe we need to eliminate them. It begs the question of why was it created in the first place? Can you walk through how the Met Council, how these other organizations determine these routes? Obviously, they're looking at data. How are they missing the mark so badly?
Mr. Carlson, how are they missing the mark so badly?
Mr. Chair, you know, maybe just speaking for Met Council, you know, it's really a balance between coverage and productivity of transit services across the region, and then managing those services so that they are cost effective. So an individual route may be put in place for various reasons of providing transit access, providing, you know, all the different benefits of transit that we described in the beginning. But it may not perform as expected. There might be a change in the underlying structure. So a new rail line or something may come in, and a route may be designed to connect to that line, but it might not perform as expected. There's a number of complex reasons why transit routes are designed. The important thing is that we manage those routes so that they present a cost effectiveness for the funds that we're stewarding as organizations.
Follow up?
So what you're saying is in some cases it's just because there isn't something going here, we should have it here. That could be a reason for creating a line, is that there isn't one currently here and maybe someone wants to get on the bus from that spot?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it really can vary. I mean, a community interest, community engagement, engagement with local governments can identify a potential need that can be evaluated. Sometimes the service is explored on a trial basis. Sometimes it works out great. Sometimes it doesn't. And how we manage and respond to that is how we effectively steward the system.
So I would say that $105.05 in a subsidy per passenger is not community interest at all. And when you're looking at this, looking at these subsidies, the outrageous amounts of money that the taxpayer dollar is spending per person on these buses almost makes me want to seek these routes out to ride on them for the sole purpose of getting some of my taxpayer dollars back in some value. Because if I sit on a bus and waste $201 in subsidies theoretically, maybe I'm getting some of my taxpayer money back. This is, in some cases, this is absolutely outrageous. So I'm very pleased to see that we're evaluating this, because this is akin to throwing money in a pit and starting it on fire.
I think that's true. And if you look at the percentage of the high subsidy compared to other pure routes, we're in the 500% higher, and that's. Members, we will have a bill getting drafted and revised, and I'm looking for input on how we can address this, because the state is bleeding money to fund our other programs, but we're also providing not very good service. I have other more choice words, but not very good service in these areas that we can do better for our transit riders and our taxpayers by addressing this issue. Our newest member, Ms. Luger-Nicolai.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Say, I have a question about whether or not it's possible to model the economic impact of having that transit available to individuals. I'm assuming even these low ridership routes enable people to get to work or to preventative medical care or to go shopping and spend money, which has an impact on our local and broader economy. And I'm just wondering if there's a way to model that. If we start looking at discontinuing routes, I think that would be relevant data.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't in this report have analysis of, you know, the utility of that basic access, but I would note that because this focuses on regular route transit, it doesn't consider the broader universe of options that may be available, like dial-a-ride service or other transportation options that could provide that service, but just not as a regular route option.
Can I follow up really quickly?
I'd love to.
And with respect to those alternative methods, are those methods ones that would shift the cost to the rider, such as the taxi service that you described earlier?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the taxi service is specific to Metro Mobility. So that's a bit of a unique circumstance. In the case of microtransit or transit link, there is a set fare structure and the balance of funding from state resources or other resources.
Thank you. Representative Jones.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, I have one comment and then two questions. First is, Representative Cagle had brought up an interesting idea about is capital included in this conversation? And I mean, this is a first stab at a study, and I think it's really important and it's really illuminating, I think, for all of us. But just a note on the capital piece, when we took a field trip down to Burnsville, I took the Orange Line and I got off at the Orange Line Transit Center, but there was an MVTA Transit Center catty corner across the two four-lane roads. So not only was it dangerous to access, we had paid twice for transit centers down there. And so that just wanted to add that as an anecdote to this conversation. The second piece is when you were talking about the difference between state and federal mandated service, you were using, I think, kind language around there's more flexibility around those. But my understanding is that if it's state mandated, then you don't have to comply within that 1 hour level of service. Is that correct?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, correct. We have more provider. Our contractor providers have more flexibility in terms of when they provide that trip. They also, in the federally mandated area, cannot differentiate by trip purpose, whereas in state, they can prioritize trips according to work or medical versus a shopping or recreational trip. That is not possible in the federal area.
Okay. Representative Jones?
Yeah, thank you for that, Mr. Chair and Mr. Carlson. I just want to point that out. I have had talked to many people in my district who have waited two and a half hours for service. And so just want to note that, like, that's not an equitable way to make sure that we have a good transportation system. I know that's not the topic of this conversation, but want to point that out. We have been talking about how these are high subsidy routes. What about the flip side? What makes good, like, what are the characteristics of a low subsidy route?
Good question, and I think it's a fair question, appropriate.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, we'll go back to the table that has the different modes and different options on here. Really, it comes down to ridership and productivity. So this is largely a function of land use, actually, where arterial BRT and light rail operate is very conducive to riders. And additionally, because they have advantages, such as signal priority, such as dedicated bus lanes or tracks in the ground, they operate at a higher speed. And that has both the function of being more attractive to riders, so more riders use it, but it also reduces the cost because the more trips can be completed in a given hour of service. So those really have a compounding effect combined with intensive land uses and richness of destinations along these corridors that creates a low cost per passenger.
If I could add on to your comment about the Orange Line near my district of Lakeville, but in Burnsville, we should talk sometime about the Red Line and the battle that was had. It was like a territorial battle where it was embarrassing as a policymaker, and I was getting calls, it was a couple years ago, where one provider was not able to use the bus platform that a different provider was. And like, there was like it was almost like a territory turf war there. Metro Transit had to park like 300 feet forward instead of using the already built platform. And it was embarrassing. I went down there and witnessed it myself. It was a couple years ago. I think there was a news story on it as well. And I'm sure we'll dig back into that. But your point about the Orange Line and having multiple facilities is part of this problem. And I don't think it should matter what color bus you're getting on if you're a rider, as long as the bus gets there and gets you to where you want to go. And for a taxpayer to not have a $200 subsidy, we can do a lot better in this state, and we have to, because this has been going on for a while. I'm glad the report came out. But it's egregious to have a $200 subsidy and think it's okay, or even a $150 subsidy, and then fight over whose park and ride it is. It's actually pretty embarrassing, and I hope that through this session we can find some solutions to provide our transit riders and transit-dependent riders and our choice riders better service and save taxpayers $20 million a year, which is basically what the report says, Mr. Carlson?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other members? I think Representative Tabke wanted some closing comments. Representative Fogelman, please.
Just really quick, maybe I'm looking at it wrong, but and if you said it already, I apologize, but I see where we've been talking about this $201 subsidy forever, but it says on this report that it was canceled because of a grant funding that was ending. So if the grant funding was still there, would this route still be going with the $201 subsidy?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm uncertain that would be a decision of the board on that provider. I believe that was a grant of state funds through the council for that specific type of service.
Okay, good. Representative Tabke, before you go to your comments, so we're going to kind of wrap up. The next committee is going to need the room. But I think this also should be noted, you know, when we talk about investing in bus, we recognize that in order to be a robust region, you do need to have some transit included in that. And I think this report, like we did with North Star, if it's not working, we need to improve it or eliminate it. But busing, if you try a route, to the conversation earlier, if you try a route, we don't know that it's always going to be successful, but that's okay. But we have an immensely less capital cost by providing a route on a bus, and then we can adjust that. And I think that's something that needs to be recognized instead of some routes that we did, you know, North Star being, I guess, the poster child of a bunch of sunk capital cost, and now, you know, finally took a long time, but we're finally stopped the bleeding on that one and saving $10 million. I hope we can stop the bleeding of $20 million a year and improve transit service. Representative Tabke, Chair Tabke.
Thank you, Chair Kosnick. I just wanted a couple things. I don't really have any questions because I've gotten to look through this and ask a lot of questions previously, but just want to say thank you to you, Chair Kosnick, for putting this was one of your provisions in the 2025 bill to get this done and get this going. And so thanks to you and thanks to my council and everybody involved for making sure that we have this data that's apples to apples comparison so that we can make good choices as to how things go. And also to a couple different things is to reinforce the fact that we need to make sure that all transit dollars are going to making sure that we have the most efficient, positive, good service for transit riders. It's really important that transit money is going to transit riders and going to benefit folks across the entire metro and making sure that we are using that as best as possible. And this data helps us to get to that information and making sure that we are doing things. And as we go through this and talk more about this into the future, we need to make sure that as we're doing these things that we're not leaving anyone behind in this process and making sure because as you could see, Shakopee has quite a few things in there and that is service provided by MVTA and it is things that people need to have as well. And so we've got folks with disabilities and other things. We have to make sure that we're taking care of those folks and not leaving them behind as we are deciding how best to use these transit dollars in the metro going forward. So I just appreciate everybody's work on this. Thank you to Met Council for all the work there. And thank you, everybody, for providing numbers. And just thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Tabke. I don't see any other member questions right now. Any closing comments, Mr. Carlson? And we may, I don't know if anybody of the public wanted to make comments, but we could entertain a couple for like 5 minutes briefly before we need to clear the room.
Mr. Chair, just thank you for opportunity to respond to the legislation and to present this report today. And I would be available for any members that would like to discuss this topic further.
We appreciate putting the report together and sharing with us today. To be clear, as we're analyzing this, what I don't care what service provider, what bus what color your bus is. We're going to hold all bus providers accountable to make sure that they deliver good service. And that includes, obviously, Metro Transit. But you're the largest, so you were able to collect this data for us, so I appreciate that. So thank you very much. I don't know that anybody from the public wanted to make any comments. There's no bill before us, so not seeing any. Members, thank you for the discussion. Chair Tabke, anything we need to know before the next committee meeting Monday? So we will be adjourned. Thank you very much, members. Meeting is adjourned.